Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Halfway between the peaks of the Andes and one of the deepest trenches in the Pacific Ocean, Chile has always been on a cliff geologically.
I would say an initiative that people need to assure food, water, electricity, and of course public order.
Chilean President Michelle Bachelet faces public disorder in some earthquake-ravaged cities. 5 days after the earth moved in Chile, how secure is the political situation? Political Cliff Notes in Chile on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, March 3rd, and The Takeaway is, how severely is public order being tested in Chile these days after the earthquake?
I would imagine public order would be tested in any city when you have that kind of disaster going on. Let's take a look at the top stories this morning. President Obama will try to push the healthcare fight into its final act today. He's expected to explain his plan to overhaul the system, embracing four Republican ideas while at the same time urging Democrats to use a budget process called reconciliation to force a majority rules vote. The Republican response, Senator Judge Gregg tells The Takeaway.
Everybody should have problems with that bill because it's such an atrocity. It's like a giant asteroid headed at the Earth.
Staying on Capitol Hill, an extension of jobless benefits was passed last night after Republican Senator Jim Bunning backed off. President Obama has already signed it. That means 2,000 furloughed federal workers also can go back to work today.
To Chile now, where the death toll is rising, along with a sense of despair in some hard-hit areas. As relief supplies finally arrive, many residents are furious with the slow government response time. We were joined earlier by Valeria Perasso, a reporter for our partner, the BBC. She joined us from Chile, where she spent a considerable amount of time in Concepcion near the epicenter of the quake. We asked her how severely the government's imposing curfews in Chile.
Well, the military forces are determined to get the curfew working, get it in place as hard as they can, because that's the only way they think they could control the mounting rise of violence, looting, and intentional fires that occurred in this city in the days after the earthquake. So yesterday night at 6 p.m., 2 hours before the night before, they decided to stop people, to tell them to go inside their houses and get the curfew in place, while military trucks were patrolling the city and checking everyone's papers to see if they had permission to stay out.
More of that interview with Valeria Perasso, a reporter for our partner, the BBC, in just a moment.
In Iraq, three suicide bombings in the city of Baquba have killed at least 30 people. U.S. officials have warned of such attacks leading up to Sunday's elections. And here at home, Texas Governor Rick Perry defeated Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson in the Republican gubernatorial primary. Perry took 51% of the vote, avoiding a runoff. He'll face former Houston Mayor Bill White in November.
Starting this morning, same-sex couples in Washington, D.C. can apply for a marriage license. Reverend Robert Hardees of the All Souls Unitarian Church says more than 200 people are expected when the doors open at the Marriage Bureau.
I can just say that we're excited to be able to marry our same-sex parishioners in our sanctuaries going forward. This is an exciting day.
Couples will have to wait at least 3 full days before exchanging vows there in Washington, D.C. Asian markets are mixed this morning. European indices are down. Futures are mixed. The Dow gets underway at 10,405. The S&P opens at 1,118. And the NASDAQ opens at 2280. Coming up, we talk about food every Wednesday, and we have an overly sweet conversation in store. Are foods evolving to get sweeter? That's a real question later on in the hour.
And our partner, the BBC, is hosting a competition to have people show off my world to the rest of the globe.
The whole of the township did not have electricity. That's why the name Duck City.
We're going to talk about this later this morning. You can get more details on our website as well. But we're asking you, what do you want others to know about you? How do you see the world?
Send a message to the world.
That's exactly right. Tell them about your place where you live. Take part by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also go to our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're looking at U.S. plans to help those affected by the earthquake in Chile. That's in just a few minutes.
Your You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Since last Saturday, when an 8.8 magnitude earthquake struck Chile, the nation's disaster response network, its military and police force, have all been tested in some of the hardest hit areas where there have been reports of curfews, looting, and vigilantes protecting their threatened property. At the same time, aid has been arriving from around the world. Yesterday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton arrived in the Chilean capital, Santiago, promising aid. And in a few moments, we'll speak with the State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley about how the earthquake may have the potential to affect the U.S.-Chile relationship. But first, let's continue our conversation with Valeria Perasso. She's a reporter for our partner, the BBC, and she joined us earlier from Concepcion, one of the cities with the most damage. And we began talking about the condition generally of the people in Concepcion.
The city still lacks electricity and running water in most of its buildings, and there are lots of people camping on the streets, people who have either lost their houses or decided to leave and stay in open spaces, camping there in tents because they are too scared to go back. Their houses show cracks, they are heavily deteriorated, and they don't want to risk being there in case an aftershock happens. So the city is full of people during the day, and then at 6 o'clock, it becomes a ghost town, literally. Everyone goes in, the curfew is in place, and only police cars and army patrols are around the streets.
Valeria Perasso, there have been reports of successes in the rescue efforts in individual buildings. Have you managed to witness people being pulled from the rubble, even given the terrible situation there?
Yeah, there's a key building, a 15-story apartment block, what used to be a 15-story apartment block, who has been torn apart and is literally standing in two pieces at the moment in the upper part of Concepcion. There were teams of at least 100 workers trying to get belongings of the people from under the rubble while they were looking for victims still trapped there. And I spoke to one of the coordinators of the security operation, and he told me that he managed to get a man the first day of the earthquake and then went back to rescue his wife and his children. Unfortunately, the man is alive, the children and the wife no longer are, but everything is very emotional. These people have had very few hours sleep and they work against the clock, literally nonstop, trying to get whatever is left there, because in 72 hours what remains of the building needs to be pulled down.
Valeria Perasso, is the presence of the military a comfort to the people in Concepcion, or are they worried that this is a sign of a crackdown?
No, everyone seems to be quite relieved to see the military officials around the city, because the previous days the looting and the violence was really, really mounting. So everyone I spoke to was preferred to have this curfew and stay inside and make sure that their belongings and their lives were safe. Even the security workers said that they had been robbed. Their equipment, their boots had been stolen by these people. So, in a way, seeing this city heavily militarized is a relief for everyone here.
Valeria Perasso, reporter for our partner, the BBC, joined us earlier from near Concepcion in Chile. Joining us now is P.J. Crowley, spokesman for the U.S. State Department. Good morning, sir.
Morning, John.
So you've heard there Valeria Perasso suggesting that people are comforted by the presence of the military. Is the U.S. At all worried about the use of military forces in these hard-hit areas, or are we pretty much sticking with the policy of Michelle Bachelet, the president of Chile, in her approach to the hard-hit areas?
Well, I don't think we're worried at all. Chile is a highly capable, advancing country. And that's one of the reasons why there's such a contrast in the response to Haiti and the response to Chile. Chile has considerable capabilities. They have experience with earthquakes, and the aid that they're requesting from the national community, including the United States, is very specific, very targeted. But they have a capable military, obviously a difficult history with that military, but civilian leadership is very sound. They're about to go through the inauguration of a new president. So this earthquake happens at a difficult time politically, but no one is questioning the control of the civilian government over Chile.
Indeed. P.J. Crowley, the spokesman for the State Department, is with us. Let's listen to your boss, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who visited Santiago yesterday.
The United States is ready to respond to the requests that the government of Chile has made so that we can provide not only solidarity, but specific supplies.
Now, we hear the Secretary of State mentioning specific supplies. You used the word specific, it seemed very deliberately a moment ago. How sensitive is the Chilean government, do you think, to this issue of international aid? The U.S. ambassador to Chile spoke yesterday that there was some concern over possibly Chile being humiliated in the same way that Hugo Chavez offering aid after Katrina to the U.S. was attempting to humiliate the United States. Not that anyone's trying to do that to Chile.
Well, I mean, one can look back to our own experience in New Orleans. There was some foreign assistance, but for the most part, we had the ability within our own country to respond to New Orleans. And likewise, you know, Chile has a great deal of experience with earthquakes. They had a devastating earthquake in 1960, and from that, they've built up their capabilities. They have very strong building codes. So, you know, whereas we talked about, you know, hundreds of thousands of deaths in Haiti, you're talking about several hundred deaths in Chile. But the things that they're looking at, bridges have been affected, so they're looking for portable bridges. As your previous reporter was talking about, you know, absence of water and electricity, so generators, water purification equipment, a field hospital. The secretary brought satellite phones with her. So they're very specific capabilities that help Chile with its response. But Chile itself, it's a government that is running a budget surplus. So there are resources within Chile to respond to this.
All right. Finally, in less than a minute before we go, P.J. Crowley, we've seen two examples of geology in the Western Hemisphere possibly strengthening the relationship between the U.S. and two important nations, Haiti and Chile. Do you see it that way?
Well, we already have a strong relationship with Chile. It will grow from this. And with Haiti, obviously, there's an important donor conference coming up at the end of March. Haiti's going to need a lot of help for a long time.
All right. P.J. Crowley is a spokesman for the State Department talking about the U.S. aid effort and the U.S. response to the earthquake in Chile and the situation in Haiti. Thank you so much. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other stories we're following this morning.
Yesterday, the Senate voted on a $10 billion bill to extend unemployment benefits and keep federal highway dollars flowing. And the result?
The ayes are 78. The nays are 19. The bill is passed.
That was Senator Kay Hagan announcing the vote. The bill had been delayed for days by a Republican senator who blocked it because of its cost. President Obama will unveil his revised health care proposal today. It's expected to embrace a handful of Republican ideas, including efforts to reduce the costs of medical malpractice. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the president is still hoping for some GOP support.
The president's still hopeful that he can get 61 votes, that there could be some hope for some bipartisanship as we go forward, and I wish him well with that.
More politics now. Some Democrats want the White House to suspend a stimulus program that finances renewable energy. They say it's creating jobs in foreign countries, not here at the United States. But an Energy Department spokesperson says the program has generated foreign investment in the U.S. Staying with energy, yesterday President Obama announced plans to offer rebates for people who weatherize their homes.
If you decided to retrofit your whole house to greatly reduce your energy use, you'd be eligible for a rebate of up to $3,000.
With congressional approval, the price tag for this program could be near $6 billion. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, what's in a number? We talked yesterday about all the numbers in the news we see. We told you how to put it in context. Your voices coming up in a few minutes. Lots of reactions we got.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now for some takeouts on stories you're following this week. Well, unless you're a baseball fan, you may not have been aware of the name Jim Bunning before this week, but a lot of people now know who the Kentucky Republican senator is. That's because Jim Bunning was the lone man to filibuster jobless benefits, payments for doctors, highway construction, small business loans, and a whole host of other programs.
The question is whether or not we as a Senate and we as a government are going to pay for what we spend.
But the senator relented last night. Joining us now is Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Celeste.
So Jim Bunning changed his mind. Too much pressure?
Well, it became clear after a couple of days of this that while Republicans do like the idea of challenging Democrats to pay for things for this $10 billion, having that challenge now in a hurting economy when people are hurting, losing their unemployment benefits, COBRA health benefits, maybe not being able to go to work on a highway project that they got a job on, just probably wasn't good politics. It was unclear when Jim Bunning would relent, but he finally did. They had a vote and the extension passed last night.
It couldn't have helped when they had people all over the news saying, I'm unemployed and I just lost my benefits because of Jim Bunning.
It couldn't have helped, and it didn't help.
That's right. So we're getting a lot of movement from the White House on health care today, and we're hearing that the president actually wrote a letter to congressional leaders yesterday. He said that after the summit, he's decided to make four specific concessions to the Republicans on health care. What are these four concessions he's talking about?
That's right, but I'm going to back you off for that just a little bit. Celeste, that word concessions makes it seemed like the president is going a long way to compromise. And this letter doesn't really reflect that. Now, it is an outreach to Republicans. The president's going to make a speech today outlining these 4 points. The president says he's willing to go further on curbing waste and fraud in the healthcare system. And Republicans will like that a little bit, but that's already in the bill. The president says he's willing to have some more experimentation in the states to curb lawsuits against doctors. That might be a bit of a concession, but there was already some nods in the bill towards experimenting with malpractice lawsuits. There was boosting Medicaid. Medicaid is the health care program for the poor. There's boosting Medicaid payments for doctors. President's willing to do that. And including health savings accounts. This is a concession. Health savings accounts are tax-free accounts. Republicans love them because they lower taxes. It's in a way sort of a voucher system for health care in a way. Democrats are not fond of this program, but the president said he's willing to include it. That's a concession. So then you wonder, are Republicans impressed with this outreach from the president? Listen to Republican leader Mitch McConnell yesterday after he read the letter.
The suggestion that we might have a few items inadequately addressed in a 2,700-page bill.
Not too impressed.
Not too impressed. So Nancy, we also heard Nancy Pelosi saying she wished the president well with this. Does that mean that Democrats are skeptical of the president's attempt to reach across the aisle?
Absolutely. We wish the president well getting bipartisanship, but Democrats feel they've had none so far. So then the plan is reconciliation, as we've talked about, which is not a bipartisan approach at all.
Lastly, let's talk about New York Congressman Charlie Rangel. He is currently the chairman for the Ways and Means Committee, but he's being charged with ethics violations, and the Democrats were hoping he would step down from his chairmanship, but he's refused to do so.
And we'll see if by the end of the day or the end of the week, Charlie Rangel is still chairman. He went into a meeting with Nancy Pelosi last night, and rumors were swirling around the Hill that Charlie Rangel was done as chairman. But when he came out of that meeting, he said, "You bet your life I'm still chairman." Republicans are going to force a vote on this, and we'll see how many Democrats want to stand by Rangel to keep him in control of one of the most powerful committees in Congress going into an election where a lot of them are going to be vulnerable. So by the end of the week, we'll see if Mr. Rangel is still in charge.
Thanks, Todd. Todd Zwillick is the Takeaway's Washington correspondent.
We're going to finish out this takeout segment by the numbers.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
We explored yesterday trying to make sense of big and small numbers in our world, from the 60-vote majority needed in Congress to that 8.8 Chilean earthquake magnitude, the recent mark of 1,000 American soldiers dying in Operation Enduring Freedom.
We as humans, every single day, we hear about Congress passing, you know, trillion-dollar budgets. We hear all these numbers every single day. So numbers don't mean a whole lot until you actually can associate a body with that number.
Perhaps you remember the voice of Pat Merrick, mother of one of those 1,000 fallen soldiers in Afghanistan. You can listen back to that interview at our website, thetakeaway.org. But we've heard from you. How do you put numbers in context?
I'm calling from Boca Raton, Florida. My name is Sam. With the superlatives that are used by the media, I think without using numbers, you have no real comprehension as to what the disaster or what the conditions might be. On the other hand, I don't believe that the human mind is capable of just dealing with a number. For example, in the Holocaust, whether you're dealing with 1,000 deaths or 100,000 deaths or 1,000,000 deaths, the numbers become incomprehensible.
But Patricia in New York emails that she doesn't like particularly how, quote, the media uses numbers in headlines that say at least this many killed. I understand, she says, that this is a shorthand to express the as-yet uncounted fatalities, but implied in the use of the words at least, there seems to me there's a hope that the number will be larger. Whatever happened to the more sober and more respectful known dead?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That is interesting. Evelyn writes us, I've lived near the Washington coast for over 25 years, and the numbers I've never gotten used to are earthquake levels. How close we are to the big one. Right up there on my list is the attendant tsunami potential, possible wave heights, how far inland it could come, etc. I don't at all have a feeling the West Coast states are prepared for either of these kinds of disasters, let alone the small, economically challenged communities in which I've lived. Local news reports following disasters like Haiti and Chile confirm that opinion.
And we're going to leave you with comments from David in Nashua, New Hampshire, who writes us a quote from Alexis de Tocqueville. He says, when statistics are not based upon computations that are strictly accurate, they mislead instead of guiding aright. The mind is easily imposed upon by the affectation of exactitude, which marks even the misstatement of statistics. And it adopts with confidence the errors which are appareled in the forms of mathematical truth.
Your affectations of exactitude are all welcome here on the program. Keep in mind this number, 8778-MY-TAKE, and you can reach us at our website, thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, how do you address segregation in our schools, whether it be racial or socioeconomic? It used to be that we used busing to do that. Now what do we do since the problem isn't solved? We're going to go to a school district in North Carolina to talk about this issue in a minute. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. This is the sound of amateur video taken at a nightclub in Valparaiso, Chile when the earthquake struck. Four days after the country was hit by its strongest earthquake in 50 years, the death toll now stands at nearly 800, and many residents are upset with the government's slow response time. Earlier this hour, State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley told us what Chile is asking the U.S. for in terms of aid.
The things that they're looking at, bridges have been affected, so they're looking for portable bridges. You know, absence of water and electricity, so generators, water purification equipment, a field hospital.
There are no plans to send U.S. troops into the region.
In Iraq this morning, three suicide bombings in the city of Baquba have killed at least 30 people. U.S. officials have warned of such attacks leading up to Sunday's elections in Iraq. Here at home, the Supreme Court seems likely to rule for the first time that gun possession is a fundamental American freedom. The court suggested yesterday it might strike down Chicago's ban on handguns, which could establish a nationwide ownership right. The Supreme Court heard arguments in a case yesterday. The Supreme Court refused to block Washington, D.C.'s gay marriage law yesterday, though, freeing the city to issue its first marriage licenses to same-sex couples today. President Obama pulls off the wraps on his revised health care proposal later today. It's expected to include a few Republican proposals, although it's unlikely to win any support across the aisle. He's also expected to urge Democrats to use a budget process called reconciliation to force a majority rule vote. And it was 65 years ago today that American Marines stormed the beaches of Iwo Jima, launching one of the fiercest battles of World War II. Nearly 7,000 U.S. lives were lost. Over 20,000 Japanese were killed. John Huffines, who fought at Iwo Jima, tells CBS News the fierce fighting became terrifying as he approached the island.
We got a little closer, and I saw that that those shells were hitting in the water and hitting on the beach, and my attitude changed. And I was pretty scared.
Today, dozens of veterans, now in their 80s and 90s, were flown to Iwo Jima for a ceremony to mark the anniversary. Let's check the markets now. Asian markets are mixed. European indices are down. Futures are mixed this morning on Wall Street. The Dow will get underway at 10,405. The S&P will open at 1,118. And the NASDAQ opens at 2280. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So Wake County, North Carolina has been the center of a racial, economic, some class issues that started with school busing. They had made attempts to integrate their school system. The Wake County School adopted a policy in 2000 in which they bused students based on their socioeconomic backgrounds. That's because it's unconstitutional at this point to bus students based on their racial background. So in order to achieve diversity, they started moving kids from poor neighborhoods into wealthier neighborhoods to go to school and vice versa. But last night, the school board that governs the district voted 5-4 to abandon the busing policy. Joining us now is Dave DeWitt. He's the education reporter for WUNC North Carolina Public Radio. He's been covering this school busing issue for the past 4 years, and he was there at last night's school board meeting. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning.
So here's the thing. When school busing programs were instituted, they were trying to address the problem of racial segregation in our schools. It's been decades since that happened. Since then, since the 1980s especially, school districts have been phasing out these busing programs. So the question for me is not why the Wake County is trying to get rid of their school busing programs, but how come Wake County still has the school busing program?
Well, Wake County, like many school districts in the South in particular, did use race as a factor in determining where students went to school. But in 2000, what it did, instead of abandoning the policy altogether, like many school districts, it switched to using socioeconomic background to bus students. And it was the first large school district in the country to do so, and it's still the largest school district in the country to do so. They did that because the school board at the time really wanted to keep diversity in the schools and wanted to deal with some of the high poverty concentrated areas that in the city of Raleigh, like many cities across the country, deal with. And so this policy has been in place for about 10 years. It's weathered some political storms and some efforts to undo it in the past, and now an effort to get that policy changed succeeded last night, as you mentioned.
But it's been very controversial. However, did it address segregation? Did you get a bigger mix of diverse students at the schools because of busing?
Well, the policy said that no school should have more than 40% low-income students. And over the years, as growth really exploded in this area here in Wake County and Raleigh, that threshold was not met in many of the schools. But certainly some, probably a dozen or more, weren't able to keep that threshold. So they were struggling to adhere to the policy itself. And as you said, there have been a lot of challenges to that policy. Whether it achieved raising the academic performance of low-income students was really a mixed bag, and a lot of folks used educational statistics on either side. Folks who disagreed with the policy cited that the high dropout rate, 54% graduation rate of low-income students, was proof that the policy wasn't working in the first place.
All right, let's go now to Patrice Lee. She's the mother of five, but she's also the director of Wake Cares. It's a parent advocacy group that opposes school redistricting plans and strongly opposes the busing program. Right, Patrice?
That's correct. I really do. Initially, when Wake County 10 years ago instituted this policy of busing for socioeconomic diversity, I think that the county pretty much embraced it, because I think we were still at a time where the county itself was not very well distributed. And I think that over the course of this explosive growth that Mr. DeWitt is referring to, I think that has shifted. There have been several reports from the News and Observer here done over the years indicating that the diversity itself within neighborhoods across Wake County has balanced itself naturally. Now, that is not to say that there are not still high concentrations of poverty in Wake County. But what we found was that, as he indicated, with this growth, it was becoming more and more difficult for the school board to reach this 40% threshold. And as a result, they were doing a variety of things. They were converting schools to mandatory year-round schedules. You were having parents with children on multiple schedules being shipped to schools an hour away if they couldn't make that schedule work for them. And it became a tremendous disruption in the lives of families. And why we are going and address this was because if it is not all things that the school board do should be driven by raising the achievement of children. And Mr. DeWitt mentioned the graduation rate. That is just one of the statistics. I mean, individually within the schools, if you look at the numbers of passing rates for end-of-course tests among economically disadvantaged children, they are not increasing.
Okay. Wait, Patrice, just one second real quick, because I looked, to go to your very first point, I looked at some maps about distribution of both race and socioeconomic status, and they're stark. Your county is really not integrated. I mean, in terms of color, blacks are concentrated in one area, whites are concentrated in another, and socioeconomically, it's very divided. That must be a concern for you, for your kids in school.
Well, I don't know that I completely agree with that. I think that there is clearly a pocket within downtown Raleigh that does have a high African-American population and a high poverty population. There's no doubt about that. But the county as a whole, and you have to remember, we are a county-based system, not a district-based system like many of them up north. Go ahead. I'm sorry. That we do have a tremendous amount of diversity.
Once you spread it out over the whole county. Patrice Lee is the director of Wake Cares, a parent advocacy group in Cary, North Carolina. And Dave DeWitt is the education reporter at North Carolina Public Radio.
So for the next few moments, let's consider the poor predicament of the United States Postal Service. It's facing dire times, predicting it will lose $238 billion over the next 10 years. Yesterday, they cried out, proposing some changes that could save them, including having no deliveries on Saturday. Ed O'Keefe joins us now. He's the author of the Federal Eye blog on the Washington Post and a federal government reporter. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning.
So you really have to be sympathetic to the Postal Service. It's a government agency, but it's not tax supported. And so the federal government dictates its service, but it can't really affect its revenues. And in an internet environment, the Postal Service is looking at declining revenues. What's a mailman to do?
Well, the Postmaster General and his aides have proposed that they cut Saturday service. He wants more flexibility to raise prices beyond the rate of inflation, which, as you said, Congress doesn't let them do right now. Their hands are tied on that. They want to be able eventually to close up to as many as 10,000 post offices across the country and move a lot of those postal services and products into nearby supermarkets or coffee shops or office depots.
Turn them into sort of ATM-style services, right?
Not only just ATM, but also you may see supermarket or Office Depot employees actually sort of acting as postal clerks in some cases.
This really struck a chord with some of our listeners. Listen to what one listener asked about what this would mean if the Postal Service got rid of Saturday delivery.
This is John in Denver. I don't have any problem with the post office cutting back to 5 days a week. But my question is, does that mean that that's less junk mail I will get? Gosh, 70% of my mail is junk mail, and there's a lot of it.
So is junk mail a good thing for the Postal Service? It's bad there for John living out there in Denver.
There would be more junk mail.
More
junk mail. And the reason is that currently there's a pretty decent level of first-class mail, but the projections are that people will send less of it, and you'll see more standard mail, which is another way of saying sort of junk mail that advertisers and retailers and whatnot send to your home. But the way the Postal Service sees it, mail is mail is mail. And as long as people are sending it, they're happy, no matter what kind of mail it is.
Ed O'Keefe, is there any internet business for the post office to get involved in to try to evolve them out of this predicament?
There is an option that they're going to explore a little further. In Europe, they have what's called hybrid mail products, where some of your mail is delivered via email in a very limited way. And the Postmaster General said they will seriously look at it, but it's a double-edged sword, because if you start to deliver too much of it that way, you're going to cut volume and revenue even further. At the same time, he said that it seems as if there is a way for them to provide some of that, and they've got to explore it.
And $3 billion savings if they cut Saturday delivery? Is that the idea?
Roughly. I mean, you're going to keep the postal trucks from running. You're going to save on gas. You're going to save on staffing. The problem is the two major labor unions that represent postal workers don't like the idea.
Indeed.
And they want them to explore other options. And there are lawmakers up on Capitol Hill who certainly don't want to rubber stamp this either.
All right. Ed O'Keefe, author of the Federal Eye blog on the Washington Post and a federal government reporter. Thanks so much.
Anytime.
The mail never stops. It just keeps coming and coming and coming. There's never a let up. It's relentless. Every day it piles up more and more and more, and you've got to get it out. But the more you get out, the more it keeps coming in. And then the barcode reader breaks, and it's published. It's clearing house.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee. I'm here with John Hockenberry. And coming up...
Too much sugar and too much cake. You end up with a bellyache.
One could arguably say Brian Wilson possibly ate a little too much sugar.
Disciplined guy, that Brian Wilson. Yeah.
One point, we're going to be talking about, not Brian Wilson, but sugar when we talk about food.
Sweet Melissa.
Are they getting
house,
too yeah. sweet? We're going to talk about sugar in just a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. President Obama is set to present his revised health care proposals today. The latest version is said to include several initiatives requested by the GOP. But that may not be enough. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell warned Democrats that the bill will be the battleground in this year's midterms.
If they are somehow able to pass this bill in the House, it will be the issue in every race in America.
The president's announcement on the bill is expected at 1:45 p.m. Eastern time today. Meanwhile, the Senate passed a $10 billion measure extending jobless benefits yesterday. President Obama signed the bill last night. It had been held up by Republican Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky, who objected to the cost.
Suicide bombers in Iraq have killed more than 30 people in attacks in the city of Bakuba this morning. The attacks come as campaigning for Sunday's parliamentary elections in Iraq continue. Joining us now, BBC correspondent Gabriel Gatehouse in Baghdad. Clearly, these bombings are part of campaign season in Iraq, correct?
I think some people will certainly see it that way. Many have been fearing that there'll be some kind of attack as polling day nears, and these certainly fit that bill, attacks on members of the security forces, and then, in fact, a third attack at a hospital as emergency services were bringing in the wounded.
Although, Gabriel, we've seen this again and again, I'm wondering if it's kind of ritualized and that the impact, the political impact and the turnout impact in Iraq is not expected to be as great as perhaps the insurgents might have anticipated.
What people are saying is that turnout, they expect it to be around 50%. That's not as high as they'd hoped, but it's not bad compared to some other countries. I think there is a fear that polling stations will be targeted on polling day itself. The authorities are mounting a massive security operation. In Baghdad alone, they're going to have 200,000 security personnel
wow.
on duty just in the capital. So I think everyone's got their fingers crossed and hoping that the attackers won't be able to get through.
Gabriel Gatehouse for our partner, the BBC, reporting from Baghdad. Texans headed to the polls yesterday to vote in primaries for the gubernatorial election. Rick Perry won the race for the Republican nomination. He's the incumbent governor, and former Houston Mayor Bill White won for the Democrats. Finally, officials in Greece are announcing new austerity measures aimed at dealing with the country's debt crisis. The crisis has rattled financial markets around the world. The Greek government says they'll save billions of dollars through measures including a hike in taxes. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
It's Wednesday and time to talk about food. And today we're going to talk about sugar, sweet things, chocolate, candy bars, cookies, brownies.
Brownies.
No, you expect sugar to be in those things, right? You know when you're eating those things that you're eating sugar. But you're also eating sugar when you eat bread. You're also eating sugar when you eat Raisin Bran. People don't often realize how much sugar they eat every single day. So the question is, are sweets really that bad? To answer us, Dr. Brian Wansink is here. He's director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell, author of Mindless Eating, and he's also the former executive director of the USDA Dietary Guidelines, so he knows a few things about sweets. And Melissa Clark also joins us, food writer extraordinaire for our partner, The New York Times. She's going to talk to us about... Melissa. She reduced sugar recipes. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Oh, it's great to be with you this morning.
So, Dr. Wansink, tell me about sugar. How is it really bad for us?
What makes sugar bad ends up being because when we eat it, we end up not eating something else we should eat. So, for instance, if we decide we're going to have four pixie sticks for breakfast, it's not
wow.
the pixie sticks are going to kill us. What it is that we don't end up eating an orange, we don't end up eating an apple, we don't end up eating yogurt because we're full. So it's actually the calories that sugar preempts that ends up being probably the worst effect on our health.
Well, you know, I've been reading a lot about sugar and the ill effects of it, but I think one of the issues here, and you can maybe argue with me, Dr. Wansink, is that perhaps people don't realize how many things have sugar in them. Like you mentioned yogurt. Actually, most yogurts have a huge amount of sugar in them.
Yeah, there's a great rule of thumb, too, that the more colors there are on the packaged yogurt, the more sugar it's going to have in it.
That's true.
That's right. Now, it is, now what's believed is that the typical person, I just got back from the American Heart Association meeting this morning at about 2:30 in the morning, and one of the things that they found is that about 355 calories, what we consume in a day, that's about 20% of what we eat, is made up of these added sugars, and it comes in all sorts of weird forms. But it's believed that about half of that in our diet ends up mainly coming from, soft drinks.
Wow. Okay, so Melissa, you, of course, are always encouraging people to get into the kitchen more and spend some quality time there. And your idea is that if we cooked our own food, we could avoid these added sugars.
Well, at least you have control over how much sugar you're adding. And that's, I think, really key. When you go out and you buy, for example, I brought this Oreo brownie bar for you guys to take a look at. And
it weighs like 6 pounds.
It's like a brick.
Well, and it's 6 pounds of pure sugar. If you look at the ingredients, sugar is listed. It's disguised, but it's listed about 6 times. There's sugar listed twice. There's high fructose corn syrup. There's regular corn syrup. There's fructose. There's a lot of sugar
in
this.
It's the backup sugar in case you don't get enough.
Then there's the chocolate. And then I made a blueberry muffin with maple syrup. There's no refined sugar. It's maple syrup is the only sweetener in that. And if you guys just want to
taste the Oreo bar first.
But the thing about cooking something at home is you're not going to add as much sugar because you don't have to. You're using real eggs, real butter, real flour. A little bit of sugar is all you need to make something taste delicious. Whereas if something is this processed, it tastes, you're not starting with real food, so you have to add a lot of sugar and salt.
But could somebody help me out here? I was reading that even if you do use natural ingredients, there are some produce that has been genetically engineered to have more sugar in it, fruit and these sorts of things, and that our sense of tasting sweet has maybe evolved in the last generation, Dr. Wansink?
Yeah, to some, and it's hard to say that they're out there engineering food to be sweeter. You know, they're a lot smarter than that. They actually are probably engineering foods that is more disease resistant, so it has a longer shelf life. I mean, hybrid crops have been going on for a long, long time. But it's also true that regardless of what flavor it is or what taste it is, that we can adapt to increased levels of it. So just in the same way that if we put salt in all our food, we need more and more salt to get a kick out of it. The same thing happens with sugar, too. The more sugar we find in our foods, the more sugar we kind of want because we read this level of adaptation that we need to satisfy.
Excuse me, Doc. Have you tried both of these?
Yeah.
It's shocking.
It is
difference.
Shocking. The Oreo brownie bar literally...
It's like a drug.
It is.
I'm dizzy.
And it's not even a real... It's not even a real taste. It doesn't even taste like a real...
Yeah.
Like, if you ask me what flavor that is, I couldn't even
sugar.
Say chocolate.
You'd
I don't
say
know.
Sugar. Exactly.
But the brownie the blueberry muffin actually tastes very sweet.
And that's all maple syrup. And the thing is, I mean, like Dr. Wansink was talking about, at least with maple syrup, the calories aren't completely empty. I mean, yes, they're not as good as, more calories like whole wheat flour. But with maple syrup, you're getting a lot of minerals. You're getting a lot of zinc. You're getting a lot of magnesium.
And
you're using a lot less because maple syrup is sweeter than sugar. So you can use less and it gives a great flavor. There's no flavoring in that except maple syrup. There's no vanilla extract. It's just all the ingredients themselves.
But here's the thing. And Dr. Wansink, maybe you can answer this because you helped to construct the dietary guidelines. People are busier now than they ever have been. And so picking up an Oreo brownie bar as distasteful as it is, and maybe as much sugar as it is, that's much faster than making a blueberry muffin.
It is. And
if we're a bad cook, the easiest way to be a better cook is to add more sugar to it, unfortunately.
Right, that's a very good point. But, I mean, the thing about baking something yourself, another thing about baking, if you say, I'm only going to eat sweets that I make myself, I mean, let's just, chances are you're not going to eat that many sweets because it does take a it takes longer to buy one, I mean, longer to make
it's
one at home.
That's a great strategy.
I know.
There's the takeaway from Melissa.
I know. Just only eat sweets you make yourself. They
okay.
taste better.
For
and,
a lot
you know.
Of people, they would stop eating sweets altogether.
Exactly.
Melissa's words to live by.
Melissa Clark is a food writer for our partner, the New York Times, and Dr. Brian Wansink, professor and director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell, also author of Mindless Eating. Thanks to both of you.
I feel like if I pointed this Oreo brownie at a kid, it would wake up. It would absolutely. If you're looking for a less sugary alternative for breakfast, you can get Melissa Clark's recipe for maple blueberry muffins at our website, thetakeaway.org. Just click on today's show. And while you're there, you can learn more about a project by our partner, the BBC. They're hosting a competition to have people show off my world to the rest of the globe. What message would you want people to know about you? If you were sending a message to planet Earth, take part by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE and find out more by going to our website, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.